Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On March 24, 2008, the court heard oral argument in Riley v. Kennedy. At issue in the case is whether Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act required Alabama to obtain preclearance of its plan to fill vacancies on a country commission through gubernatorial appointments rather than special elections. Bradley Arendt Rose and Weiss and former Alabama Solicitor General Kevin Newsom, who argued for the appellant, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Attorney Newsom.
Hello, my name is Kevin Newsom of Bradley Arendt Rose and White in Birmingham, Alabama. This is a podcast concerning Riley v. Kennedy, number 07-77, which I argued in the Supreme Court on behalf of Alabama Governor Bob Riley on Monday, March 24. It is appropriate that this podcast is being sponsored by the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, because in our briefs we described the district court's decision, which we were challenging, as resulting in a, quote, federalism and separation of powers double whammy, close quote. What fun. At bottom, Riley v. Kennedy is a case about the method of filling vacancies on county commissions in Alabama. I know, big yawn. But it's also a case that raises some pretty interesting and pretty profound federalism questions. Every case, of course, is interesting once you've been inside of it for 6 months. I hope I can make this podcast interesting for folks who will be spending no more than the next 6 minutes thinking about it. All right, so let's start at the top. The Riley case arises under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Section 5, as some may know, establishes a preclearance regime that requires certain covered jurisdictions, principally, although not uniformly, I suppose, southern states and localities to obtain permission, either from DOJ's voting section or from the U.S. District Court in D.C. each time they intend to change a voting practice or procedure. Typically, indeed overwhelmingly, Section 5 has been applied to ordinary legislative and administrative changes. What makes the Riley case interesting is that for the first time, the Supreme Court is being asked whether Section 5 applies to changes wrought by the purely judicial decisions of state courts. Here's how the case sets up. For more than 125 years, the general statutory law in Alabama has provided that vacancies on county commissions are to be filled through gubernatorial appointment. In 1985, the Alabama legislature enacted a local law, Act 85-237, which applied only to Mobile County and which provided that vacancies on the Mobile County Commission should be filled through special election. The U.S. Department of Justice precleared Act 85-237 in June of 1985. Preclearance, I should say now before things get terribly confusing, certifies that a statute or practice complies with Section 5, but it is not, in the words of Section 5 practice, retrogressive with respect to minority voting rights. It does not, however, bless the law as valid and enforceable for all times and all purposes. In any event, in 1987, a vacancy arose on the Mobile County Commission, and litigation immediately ensued in state court about the proper method of filling it. A Mobile County voter contended, as relevant here, that 85-237 violated the Alabama Constitution's generic prohibition on local laws that address the subjects covered by general laws. State trial court rejected the argument and declined to enjoin the special election, which resulted in the election of a gentleman named Sam Jones. On appeal, however, the Alabama Supreme Court reversed in a decision titled Stokes v. Noonan. All this will become relevant. It held that Act 85-237, quote, clearly offended the literal language, close quote, of Section 105 of the Alabama Constitution. For those who are following closely, the question might arise, what would become of poor Sam Jones, who had been chosen in an unconstitutional election? And the answer is that the Alabama governor at the time, Guy Hunt, solved the problem by simply appointing Jones to the seat pursuant to his authority under the general statutory law. All right, now flash forward 15 years. In 2004, the Alabama legislature amended the general law to add a proviso whereby county commission vacancies should be filled by gubernatorial appointment, quote, unless a local law authorizes a special election. DOJ precleared that amendment in 2004. Shortly thereafter, in 2005, a vacancy arose on the Mobile County Commission again when the same Sam Jones was elected mayor of Mobile and vacated his commission seat. As it had before, litigation ensued in state court concerning the appropriate method of filling the vacancy. Yvonne Kennedy, James Buskey, and Williams Clark, the appellees in my case, sued in state court seeking a declaration that the amendment to the general law had in essence revived the unconstitutional Act 85-237. State trial court granted that relief, but the Alabama Supreme Court unanimously reversed in a decision styled Riley v. Kennedy. It held that the plain language of the amendment to the general law provided for prospective application only, and that the amendment's language, quote, must be given effect according to its terms, close quote. The amendment, in other words, paved the way for the legislature to enact new local laws, but it did not resurrect dead ones. Relying on the Alabama Supreme Court's decisions in Stokes v. Noonan and Riley v. Kennedy, Governor Bob Riley, my client, appointed Juan Chastain, who, it should be noted, happens to be African-American, to fill the vacancy on the Mobile County Commission. All right, so Kennedy, Buskey, and Clark then sued, filed a challenge under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in federal court alleging that the state of Alabama was required but failed to pre-clear the Stokes and Riley decisions. A three-judge district court agreed and held that, quote, the state court decisions should have been pre-cleared before they were implemented, close quote. In particular, the district court concluded, number one, that Act 85-237 was the appropriate baseline for measuring the supposed Section 5 change. Number two, that in holding Act 85-237 invalid on state law grounds, the Alabama Supreme Court had changed the law as that term is understood in Section 5 practice. And therefore, three, that the Stokes and Riley decisions should have been pre-cleared before they were implemented. The state thereafter submitted the Stokes and Riley decisions to DOJ for preclearance, but DOJ objected. In so doing, it said that despite the Alabama Supreme Court's invalidation of Act 85-237 on state constitutional grounds in 1988, the Act and its provision for a special election to fill the vacancy, quote, remained in full force and effect, close quote. Now, with that précis, the federalism implications of the case, I hope, are fairly obvious. Even with respect to Section 5's more traditional applications to state legislative and administrative actions, the Supreme Court has emphasized that the preclearance requirement works what it is called, quote, an extraordinary departure from the traditional course of relations between the states and the federal government, close quote. Now, the court to this point has been willing to accept that extraordinary departure, but it has also warned that it will not construe Section 5 so as to, quote, exacerbate the substantial federalism costs that the preclearance requirement already exacts, close quote. The question here, therefore, is whether application of Section 5's preclearance regime to state court decisions is simply Section 5 business as usual, or instead is the sort of exacerbation that the court has said it will resist. In our briefs and at the argument, we try to convince the court that there really is something different and in some sense more serious going on here. I'll try to keep this short and sweet. First, there is a jurisdiction stripping angle. On the district court's view, the moment a state statute is precleared as compliant with Section 5, it is, no matter how unconstitutional it may be as a matter of state law, effectively frozen in place as a Section 5 baseline. Because any invalidation of the precleared statute would by definition result in a Section 5 change requiring preclearance, the state courts cannot, at least absent additional permission from DOJ, discharge their sovereign responsibility of judicial review. Something about that, to us anyway, just doesn't feel right. Second, think about what happens when, as here, DOJ refuses to give its blessing. The state is stuck, for all intents and purposes, with an unconstitutional law. The Alabama Supreme Court, remember, held back in 1988 that Act 85-237 was unconstitutional and thus void. Almost 20 years later, in refusing to pre-clear the decision, DOJ said to the contrary, that Act 85-237, quote, remains in full force and effect. Again, maybe I've been sipping my own Kool-Aid for too long, but something about that just doesn't feel right. Why, you might ask, as did one of the justices at the argument, is the affront to federalism any worse when DOJ countermands a state court's interpretation of state law than when it countermands a state legislature's statute or a state executive's order? There are two answers, I think. One, it's worse because it's more. Section 5 is an extraordinarily broad statute as it is, and it already intrudes quite deeply into state and local affairs. With respect to any proposed extension into heretofore uncovered areas, the heavy presumption, it seems to me, ought to be against. Two, it's worse because, as I said at the argument, we are living, for better or worse, in a post-Marbury, post-City of Burning world in which courts as such are the final expositors of constitutional doctrine. It is therefore one thing to require a state to maintain and enforce a statute that for policy reasons it would prefer to change. It is quite another thing to require a state to maintain and enforce a statute that its own high court has held that it may not constitutionally have. Thanks for listening. It's an interesting case, very much underneath the radar, I think. I would guess we could expect an opinion any time between late April and late June.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.